What's the meaning of life? It's not a little question, is it? It's a big question. It's one that we all try our best to answer. In fact, it's the ultimate question, because all of us will live life as if we know what gives it meaning. I wonder if you've seen on TV this week, Marks and Spencers have a new advert out. If Ian pops the slide on, you can see a picture from the end of it. It lists a number of things that you should say no to, well, if you're a lady, okay? So, no to the uncomfortable, no to the awkward, no to the painful, no to the disappointing friends. Why? Because, very simply, life is too short. And it ends with this tagline: we only get one life, let's spend it well. But it raises the question, what does it look like to spend life well? How do we do that in real life? In the advert, it's about saying no to the hard, the uncomfortable, the disappointing, and only doing things, and this is one of the lines, only do things that make you feel 10 feet tall. Okay? And yet, that's an impossible dream, isn't it? If you were only to do the things that made you feel 10 foot tall, only do the things that you found joy in, right? It's an advertiser's dream, but that's all it is. That we can't all quit our jobs the moment we don't like it. If you don't feel like feeding your kids, you can't therefore not feed your kids. You can't always eat, as one of the pictures is, as an idyllic family around a beautiful table on a jetty over a sunset dappled lake. That can't be every breakfast, dinner and tea. It's a nice ideal, isn't it? But actually, it's just not reality. Is that the only way to spend life well, to escape reality? Or is there actually joy to be found in the ordinary, in the everyday? Can we find meaning that holds in the hardship of suffering as well as on the sunset dappled beach? That's as true on the day of our child's birth as the moment when we close our eyes in death. Is there a meaning of life that's not just an escapist dream, but is grounded in the everyday? That is not just for a weekend, but we can take with us into our Wednesday and our Thursday and our Friday. Now, in Ecclesiastes, as we come to this book, the preacher agrees that we only get one life, let's spend it well. He would agree with the Marks and Spencers advert that far. He wants us, however, to recognise our mortality, that life is short, but he also wants us to find a purpose that enables us to live life with joy in the ordinary and the everyday. Not an escapist ideal, but in the work world of work. Toil, labour, death. How do we find joy in our job? That's one of the questions he's going to help us look at. How do I find joy in a difficult relationship? How do I find joy in education? How do I find joy in science with the worst teacher in the school on a wet Wednesday morning in November? How do I find joy as the teacher with the worst set of pupils in the world on a wet Thursday afternoon when they just don't want to learn? See, Ecclesiastes is about joy in life. Not escaping life, but ultimately, he says, we can only find joy in life, we can only really spend life well, once we recognise that what gives life meaning is outside of just this world. If we just look for the sense of meaning of life in the world, we'll never enjoy it. It will always be escaping us. But the meaning of life is knowing God. Now, in many ways, Ecclesiastes is just a really long sermon. Okay, 12 chapters. Be grateful that I don't preach for that long. That's what he is. He's the preacher, verse 1. It says teacher, but the word also means preacher. He's gathered people together and he is preaching to them. At this point, he's probably an old man. It could be Solomon. There's lots of debates. But we're going to refer to him as the preacher. He's an old man having explored lots of things, having tried lots of things, giving his conclusion on what he has discovered about the meaning of life. Now, let me say, Ecclesiastes is not an easy book. I've tried to steer away from this term, and just I don't feel I can. I think we've got to look at this. It's not an easy book to study, partly because its teaching is fairly unique. Not in its message, but in the way it does it. It is quite confrontational. It confronts us with issues and poses questions that are designed to get under our skin and irritate us. That's the way it works. It partly helps us find joy by disabusing us of the things that we actually think will bring us joy. It does a knocking down job before it can do a building up job. There will be times in this series when it feels brutally painful for some of us. It exposes our hearts. It exposes the things that we've just begun to slip into finding meaning in. And ultimately it shows us that seeking out meaning in anything under the sun, anything that is just in the world, is futile and will disappoint us. You see, what he's doing is he's exposing the ruin of Eden. A perfect world God made and made good, but that is now marred by sin. And yet he's showing us we have this continuing desire to live in Eden and find joy and contentment. And yet we're tempted to look in the wrong places. But ultimately in Ecclesiastes, God is drawing us to find real joy in him, not in stuff, but in such a way that it will change the way we deal with everything. So we're going to start with the introduction this morning. These verses are the kind of introduction. The body comes kind of chapters 2 through to 11, and then there's a little conclusion at the end. So let's begin with his introductory statement. Look at verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What a depressing summary to begin with, isn't it? You might be thinking, I'll stop the series, I'm going to go somewhere else for the next 12 weeks. I can't put up with meaningless every week. Let me just say, don't write the preacher's sermon off yet. It's partly a problem with English. The word that gets translated meaningless here is actually the Hebrew word that means breath. Vapor. Temporary. Fleeting. Isn't that different to meaningless? Meaningless kind of sucks you into a depressing well of, oh, what's the point? Okay, but a breath doesn't have that same connotation, does it? A vapor. So vapor, says the teacher. Utterly vaporous, everything is just like a vapor. It is there, but it's transient. You try and grab hold of it, but it trickles out through your fingers. And that's the first point he wants us to get. Life is just a breath. What he wants us to get. It is just a breath. It is here one minute, it is gone the next. And let me say, he's not the only person to think of life like this. Turn to Psalm 39. In Psalm 39, David is giving a song for God's people to sing, and he expresses this same idea. Psalm 39, verses 5 and 6. You have made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Everyone is but a breath, even those who seem secure. Look at verse 11. When you rebuke and discipline people for their sins, you consume their wealth like a moth. Surely everyone is but a breath. Or you could go to Psalm 62. Psalm 62 and verse 9. Another psalm of David. And here he looks at, is there any difference between the wealthy and the poor? He says, surely the lowborn are but a breath, the highborn are but a lie. If weighed on a scale, they are nothing together, they are only a breath. He says, look, everybody, no matter who you are, no matter how substantial you think your house is or your bank account is or how poor you are just a breath. Go to Psalm 144. It's another psalm of David. Psalm 144 and verses 3 to 4. Lord, what are human beings that you care for them? Mere mortals that you think of them. They are like a breath. Their days are like a fleeting shadow. Okay? I mean, how do you chase through the Psalms? Come back to Ecclesiastes. See, he's expressing here an idea that is familiar to God's people. Life. Human life, our life, is like a breath. It is temporary, it is not permanent, no matter how much we live life as if it was. In the scale of history, we are here one minute and gone the next. Our lives are temporary. Like a breath you breathe out on a cold morning that just disappears within seconds. But notice, the preacher isn't just talking about our lifespan. Look at what he says. Look at the final line. Everything is meaningless, or everything is like a breath. Everything. Everything in the world is passing. The things we are tempted to grasp onto are just temporary. It's like a vapor that you just can't grab onto, that you can't hold no matter how hard you try. The preacher wants us to face up to the reality that the things we look to give us meaning are temporary no matter what they are. They're here today, they're gone tomorrow. They can't hold the weight of what we're trying to put on them. So think about that for a second. Think about your job that you currently do. Okay? No matter how you feel about it now, in the run-up to that job, you were excited about it. Do you remember back to those days, you know, those naive days? When you thought, wow, this job's going to give me a sense of purpose and meaning and joy, and I will love this. Okay, if you didn't, you're a sad cynic. Okay? You hoped for all these positive, you know, if you're a teacher, I'll be able to mould the minds of inquiring, keen to learn young people to be the generation that improves the future. There's the blurb from Teach First. Okay? It's not really. All right? But that's the idea, isn't it? Or you know, if you're in healthcare, you've got all these positive dreams, the difference you will make. And yet, ultimately, let's be honest, work proves to be frustrating. Our colleagues can prove to be less than stellar. And ultimately, satisfaction eludes us. We just end up with a bottomless list of to-dos that we never reach. It's the same if you're a parent, isn't it? Well, think about marriage. Our marriage begins with that great day full of hopes and dreams that actually is nothing like the reality we've just promised. The dreams soon lose their honeymoon edge. It cannot and was not designed to be the thing we look to for meaning. No matter how good our marriage is, no matter how much we love our husbands and wives, we know, don't we, that there are times we clash. We know that there are imperfections, difficulties and struggles. It cannot bear the weight of being the thing that gives meaning in life. If you don't know it, your kids do. The idyllic family life that we imagine in those 9 months before the birth of our first child, that quickly proves to be no more than a puff of wind in the battle of sleep deprivation, or the moody silences of teenage years, or simply the clash of sibling rivalry. See, we keep on fixing our hopes on something else that will be the thing that makes life click, that will enable us to spend life well, that will give us a sense of satisfaction. It might not be any of those things. It could be the next gadget or the next experience. And we keep on pursuing those things, don't we? The next. If only. But joy, contentment and meaning keep on eluding us, slipping through our hands like breath through the kids' fingers. And that's what the preacher wants us to realise. See, life is a breath. He wants us to recognise that reality. We tend to look for meaning in things that weren't designed to give us meaning, but are signposts pointing us to where we find meaning. Things that just can't take that weight. And therefore we end up being disappointed, disillusioned and bitter because it slips like breath through our fingers. Now let me say, the teacher doesn't want to depress us, but he does want to, before he builds joy, knock down the things that we're tempted to look to for a joy that won't last. Because unless we see the things we tend to fix our hopes on are just a breath, we will never look beyond them. I wonder, what is it that you are tempted to think will bring meaning or joy or contentment? There will be something for each of us. It could be, if only I was healthy again. If only I could do this or that. If only I could change him or her. If only we could just reshape life to be like this. If only I could give up work. If only I could find work. See, all those things. And yet when we get them, we soon find that they leave us looking for something else. Because life is just a breath. Here's the second thing. That life is lived in the real world. The question is kind of, why is life like that? Why do we look for meaning and contentment in things that can't sustain it? And look at verse 3. The preacher asks a question. What does anyone gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? What's the answer he's expecting back? Nothing. There you are. Write that above your mirror when you're getting ready for work tomorrow. Okay? And in his sermon, he's going to unpack examples for us of just that. Education, friendship, work, success, sex, reputation, power, wealth. All things we labour and toil at, but that ultimately don't bring us gain. But notice in the language he uses to frame his question, he hints at why that is. He uses a few phrases. Notice that. He talks about, what does anyone gain from all their labours at which they toil? And then the little phrase, under the sun. The phrase under the sun is one of the key phrases in the book of Ecclesiastes. It means under the sun, just looking at the physical world. Ignoring any spiritual realm. Just looking at what I can see. The world as it is. And he's saying, look, what's the point if I'm only looking at things under the sun? But he also gives us another hint. The words labour and toil are meant to ring some Bible alarm bells for us. Where do we first hear those words? Genesis 3. Here's Eden. God makes a world that is good. He puts mankind into a world that is good. And work is a joy. Relationships are a joy. Why? Because they are held in their right place. The greatest thing they enjoy is knowing God, and everything else flows from that. And yet those words, labour and toil, draw us back to Genesis 3. Adam and Eve sin, they fall, and the world is cursed. And now, because of sin, work is hard. Meaning is hard to find. Why? Because we've lost the primary important thing, the relationship with God that we were made to find our joy and our meaning of life in. The Ecclesiastes is the examination of a life lived in a fallen world. A world where you just look at the physical. Can you find meaning if you discount God is one of the key questions. And yet where you were made with all the desires for life in Eden. See, God made a world good, placed mankind in it to enjoy its goodness, to find their sense of meaning, not in the world, but in God who made the world, to enjoy relationship with him forever. But at the fall, all of that is lost. Eden is ruined, but there is still a glimpse of that glory. But there is also garbage. And yet we still long for what we knew in Eden. Ecclesiastes is not a Disney film. Each section doesn't end with a happily ever after and a sunset. It ends deliberately like real life, with frustration and questions and a sense of something missing, but a desire to find it. Because Ecclesiastes is seeking to show us how to spend life well in the real world, not escape the world. It does so by disabusing us of the notions of a Disney life now, by giving us a hope that is greater than that. See, we were made to find our joy in God and serve in a world of goodness. We still have those impulses. That's why suffering feels so wrong. That's why death feels so wrong. That's why grief is so real and so painful. We still have all those impulses to know something bigger, to know someone greater. But we tend to mistakenly search for joy in a trinket found amid the rubble, rather than looking beyond the world to God. But God, through the preacher, wants to show us how to find real life, real joy, real meaning in the real world. He wants to help us view all those things rightly, because we get that relationship with God right. Because God wants us to find joy in our work, in our relationships, in money, in position, in all those things. He's not against them, but he wants us to put them in the right place so that we're not disappointed and crushed by them again and again. See that question? What does anyone gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? The answer is nothing. Why? Because we were made for more than life under the sun. The answer is not under the sun. The answer is above the sun. Do you recognise the reality of the world the preacher shows us? We are all tempted, aren't we, to try and escape from the reality of Eden ruin. We try and shield ourselves from pain and suffering, from difficulty. That's why when the images of a famine come on the telly, what do? You turn it off or you turn it over. That's why we as a society hide death and sickness away. Do you recognise the reality? How do you answer that question he poses? What do you gain from all your labour at which you toil? What is the point? Eden's been lost, he says. But it is still possible to live in Eden ruin with a hope of Eden restored. And as he shows us his answer, he helps us see real life. He weans us off those things we're tempted to look at and calls us to look beyond the sun. Here's the last thing for this morning. It's this. He shows us ultimate realities in verses 4 through to 11. In verses 4 to 11, he begins to unpack in his introduction his answer to that question. What do we gain? What do we leave behind? The answer we've seen is nothing. Look at verse 4. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Look, you're temporary. You're a breath. The earth has seen billions of little human beings like you scurrying about on the surface. And how many do you remember? In verses 5 to 8, he uses nature to teach us. It's one of the features of wisdom literature. You know, it's good for us to stop and look at nature and think, what is God teaching me? Look at verses 5 to 8. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. What's the point with those three cycles? His point is, they are never finished. The wind never goes home and puts its feet up. It is just somewhere else. The sun that never thinks it's time for a coffee break. It just keeps on going down and up, down and up, down, or round and round as we know it, although it looks like down and up. Water, think of the water cycle. I'm not going to do it, don't worry. It's not a science lesson. But you know, it's a poetic way of describing it, isn't it? The streams flow into the sea, the seas never fall to the place the streams come from. There they return again. He's got evaporation and all the other stuff in there. Okay? What's his point? There is no end to those cycles. Look what he says, verse 8. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The end, the eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear is full of hearing. You see what he's saying? That we are just like them. There is always more for us to see, more for us to hear, more for us to search for. I bet none of you have ever been to a film at the cinema and come out and said, you know what, I never need to see another film again. Or read a book and thought, you know, that was so good, I've reached the pinnacle of all books. There will never be another book worth reading on the planet. You never think that about a song you hear, do you? Let's be honest. Our eyes and our ears itch to hear more, to find out more, to learn more, to discover more, hoping we will find that thing. But we can never find it. That's his point with the sun, the wind, and the water image. We are just like them on an endless cycle. Look at verses 9 to 10. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. Saying, look, we constantly pursue novelty. We hope something new might be the answer. If I could just... But actually the impulses driving those things are the same as there's always been. He's not saying no one has ever created anything new. There were iPads in Jesus' time, or before Jesus' time in Solomon's time. That's not what he's saying. But he's saying there is nothing that really does something new. You think about it. You think about Skype. You think about FaceTime and all that sort of stuff. Great means of communication, aren't they? But when you boil it down, it is just a different way to communicate. The impulse is the same. I want to find meaning in relationships. I want to make connections. You think about exploration. You know, the talk of a manned mission to Mars and all that kind of stuff. You could say, well, that's something new, except, you know what, man has always been exploring. Man has always wanted to know what's around the corner, what's down there, what's up there. How much further do I get? Why searching for meaning? That's what he's saying. All the things that we think are new are actually just a fresh expression of something old. We are always restlessly searching for meaning and cannot find it. These things are new, but they are not new in their goal and their aim, what they're trying to do. They don't break the cycle, they just continue it. We restlessly search for meaning. And look at verse 11. There is no remembrance of people of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. Here's a question. Do you remember your grandparents' names? Who remembers their grandparents' names? Can you remember what their jobs were? Okay, how about your great-grandparents? You can remember their great-grandparents' names and their jobs. Who can remember their great-great-grandparents' jobs and names? Interesting, isn't it? How easily forgotten we are. And look at verse 11. Even those who are yet to come will not be remembered. Here's what it's saying. Mums and dads, two generations' time, three generations' time, no one will know who you were. No one will know you were sat in this room on Sunday the 7th of May. That's quite a sobering thought, isn't it? That is quite sobering. Now, we fight against that, don't we? We want to be remembered. What is it that all politicians talk about? Leaving a legacy. Okay. Interestingly, we tend to remember the bad ones longer than we remember the good ones. But do you know what? In 400 or 500 years, how many of those will be remembered? How many of the policies they fought for, the things they've done? See, life is fleeting. It is just a breath. And one day we will die and be forgotten. We fight against that. We want to be remembered. That's why the wealthy fund hospital wings and libraries they can stick their name on. Except you see the name and think, I've got no idea what that's about. But ultimately, we won't be remembered by those who follow us. Saying, look, saying, see the brevity of life. Given the restless searching and the ultimate reality of our death and not being remembered, spend life well now. Recognize there is no answer under the sun. Under the sun there is only restless searching, a chasing of a tail, a search for something new but never found. There is no answer in the rubble of Eden. Nothing that we gain from our labour under the sun. But he is not saying give up work or give up trying or sit in a corner or anything worse. He's not saying find some tablets and take them. It's not what he's saying. He's saying we can know joy and peace and contentment and meaning, but we've got to look for it in the right place. And let me say there are two reactions to this start of Ecclesiastes this morning. There is a deep, deep, one reaction is a deep, deep sense of, you know, what's the point? Maybe you're mentally writing your resignation letter. If that's how Ecclesiastes has made you feel, you know what? Part of me says that's bad and part of me says it's good. Because what it's exposing is we are looking for meaning just under the sun. The problem is what Ecclesiastes is doing it is knocking down the things that you're tempted to put your sense of meaning and well-being on. Your job, your wealth, your relationship, sex, power, reputation, any of those things. God in Ecclesiastes is thundering at us, don't do it. It is pointless. You become like a hamster running on a wheel, not knowing the sunflower is outside the wheel stuck on the cage. You can't get it. If our reaction to Ecclesiastes is just a deep sense of loss, a sense of what's the point, it's because it's showing us we're looking for meaning in the wrong place. And let me say, even as Christians, we can find ourselves tempted to do that. We know the theology, but really in the day-to-day, what am I living for? What is giving my life meaning? Here's the second reaction. It's live life looking above the sun. See what Ecclesiastes is saying? If I was made by God, if we were made by God to find joy and meaning, then there must be somewhere we can find it. If it isn't under the sun, then it must be above the sun. Not in the creation, but in the Creator. God is not playing philosophical games with us. In Ecclesiastes, he's trying to wean us off what will harm us. He is lovingly warning us. So that instead of looking under the sun, instead of looking to stuff, we look to him. And the more amazing thing that we see as the history of salvation unfolds is that, amazingly, God doesn't just stand there and thunder from heaven, God the Father determines with God the Son, through God the Spirit, for the Son to step down, to share in the life of frustration under the Son, to walk amid the rubble and ruin of Eden in order to point us to and enable us to enjoy a relationship with God again. And he says some very Ecclesiastes-like things. What will it gain a man, as the rest of it gain, if he gains the whole world and yet loses his soul? That's the message of Ecclesiastes, isn't it? You think of his, the parable he tells of the rich man with his barns. And what does God say? You fool! This night your soul will be required from you. What's the message there? Don't put your hopes, don't live life for the things under the sun.